He's coming on strong. The position he'd given Linda Greenlaw on the Hannah Bowden, 44 North, 56.4 West, is a departure from his original heading. It appears to be more the heading of a man bound for Halifax, Nova Scotia, or maybe even Louisburg, Cape Breton Island, than Gloucester, Massachusetts. Louisburg is only 250 miles to the northeast, a 24-hour drive with the seas at their stern. Maybe Billy, having looked down the barrel of the gun, has decided to dodge north like Johnston. Or maybe he's worried about fuel, or needs to pick up ice, or decides that the cold countercurrent inside Sable is starting to look pretty good. Whatever the reason, Billy changes course sometime before 6 p.m. and neglects to tell the rest of the fleet. They all assume he's headed straight for Gloucester. Albert Johnston on the Mary T., Tommy Barry on the Allison, and Linda Greenlaw on the Hannah Bowden all hear Billy Tyne's 6 o'clock bulletin on the weather. Only Linda is worried. "Those boys sounded scared, and we were scared for them," she says. The rest of the fleet is more nonchalant. "We live in this stuff for years and years," says Barry. "You have to look at the charts, listen to the weather, talk to the other boats, and make a decision on your own. You can't just go out there and wait for nice weather." The storm is centered around Sable Island, but its far western edges are already brushing the New England coast. The Satori, now too far offshore to abort the trip, starts to feel the storm as early as Sunday morning. Another wall of fog moves in from George's Bank, and the barometer starts a slow downward slide that can only mean something very big is on the way. The Satori is at the top of the Great South Channel off Cape Cod, and working her way through an increasingly restless and uneasy sea. Stimson mentions the weather forecasts again, but Leonard insists there's no reason to worry. By Sunday morning, the swells start to mound up in ominous, chaotic ways, and that afternoon, when Stimson tunes in to the NOAA weather broadcast, she feels the first stabs of fear. Northeast wind, 30 to 40 knots, average seas, 8 to 15 feet, visibility under 2 miles in rain. By nightfall, the wind swings out of the northeast, as predicted, and starts to climb steadily up the Beaufort scale. It's clear that both the Satori and the boat she left Portsmouth with are in for a bad night. The two crews talk every hour or so over the VHF, but by midnight on Sunday, the air is so highly charged that the radios are useless. Around 11 o'clock, Stimson takes one last call from the other boat. "We're having a rough time and have lost gear on deck," and they're not heard from again. The Satori heads alone into the night, straining crazily up the swells and struggling to maintain steerage way. Monday dawns a full gale, the seas building to 20 feet and the wind shearing ominously through the rigging. The sea takes on a gray, marbled look, like bad meat. Stimson tells Leonard that she really thinks it's going to be a bad one, but he insists it'll blow itself out in 24 hours. "I don't think so, Ray," Stimson tells him. "I've got a bad feeling." She and Leonard and Bylander eat chili cooked by Stimson's mother and spend as much time as possible below deck, out of the weather. The navigation table is across from the galley on the starboard side, and Bylander sets herself up as the communications person, monitoring the radar and weather forecasts and tracking their position by GPS. A dash into shore would be risky now, across shipping lanes and dangerous shoal waters, so they reef down the sails and keep to open sea. Monday night, the storm crosses offshore, and the first stage wind surge passes over the Satori. NOAA Weather Radio reports that conditions will ease off briefly and then deteriorate again as the storm swings back toward the coast. By then, though, the Satori might be far enough south to escape its full wrath. They wallow on through Monday night, the barometer rising slightly and the wind easing off to the northeast. But then late that night, like a bad fever, it comes on again. The wind climbs to 50 knots, and the seas rise up in huge dark mountains behind the boat. The crew take turns at the helm, clipped into a safety line, and occasionally take a breaking sea over the cockpit. The barometer crawls downward all night, and by dawn the conditions are worse than anything Stimson has ever seen in her life. For the first time, she starts thinking seriously about dying at sea. Meanwhile, 500 miles to the east, the Sword Fleet is getting slammed. On Albert Johnston's boat, the crew is so terrified that they just watch videos. Johnston stays at the helm and drinks a lot of coffee. Like most captains, he's loath to relinquish the helm unless the weather calms down a bit. On the Andrea Gale, Billy probably takes the helm while the rest of the crew go below and try to forget about it. Some guys get stoned, which keeps them calm, and some sleep, or try to. Others just lie on their bunks and think about their families or their girlfriends, or how much they wish this wasn't happening. "I picture it like this," says Charlie Reed, trying to imagine the last evening aboard the Andrea Gale. "The guys are down below reading books, and every now and then the boat takes a big sea on the side. They run up to the wheelhouse and ask, 'Hey, what's going on, Cap?' And Billy says something like, 'Well, we're getting there, boys, we're getting there.' If Billy's going down sea, it has to be an awful frightening ride. Sometimes you come off the top of one of those waves and it just kind of leaves out from under you. The boat just drops. It's better to take the seas head on. At least that way you can see what's coming at you. That's about all you can do." Of the men on the boat, Bugsy, Murph, and Billy have the most time at sea. 34 years all told, much of it together. At home, Billy has a photo of the three of them at sea with a gigantic swordfish. He has hip boots on, rolled down to his shins, and he's sitting on a hatch cover pulling open the fish's mouth with a steel hook. He's staring straight into the camera. Bugsy's just behind Billy, head cocked to one side, looking as gaunt and ethereal as Christ on the Shroud of Turin. Murph's in back, squinting into the sea glare and noticeably huge, even beneath a bulky pair of Farmer John waders. All these men have seen their share of close calls at sea, but Murph's record is the worst. He's 6'2", 250 pounds, covered in tattoos, and apparently extremely hard to kill. Once a Mako shark clamped its jaws around his arm on deck, and his friends had to beat it to death. The Coast Guard helicoptered him out. Another time he was laying out the long line when an errant hook went into his palm, out the other side and into a finger. No one saw it happen, and he was dragged off the back of the boat and down into the sea. All he could do was watch the hull of his boat get smaller and smaller above him and hope someone noticed he was gone. Luckily, another crew member turned around a few seconds later, understood what was happening, and hauled him in like a swordfish. "I thought I was gone, Mom," he told his mother later. "I thought I was dead." The worst accident occurred on a sticky, windless night off Cape Canaveral. Murph tried sleeping up on deck, but it was too hot, so he went below to see if it was any better down there. The air conditioning was broken, though, so he went back up on deck. He was half asleep when a tremendous shriek of metal brought him to his feet. The boat lurched to one side, and water started pouring into the hold. A sleek, dark shape loomed in the water off their bow. After the bilge pumps kicked in and the boat stabilized, they turned their searchlights on it. They'd been run down by the conning tower of a British nuclear submarine. It had ripped a hole in the hull and crushed Murph's bunk like a beer can. With all this catastrophe in his life, Murph had two choices. Decide either that he was blessed or that his death was only a matter of time. He decided it was only a matter of time. When he met his wife, Deborah, he told her flat out he wasn't going to live past 30. She married him anyway. They had a baby, Dale Jr., but the marriage broke up because Dale Sr. was always at sea. And a few weeks before signing on to the Andrea Gale, Murph had stopped by his parents' house in Bradenton for a somewhat unsettling goodbye. His mother reminded him that he needed to keep up on his life insurance policy, which included burial coverage, and he just shrugged. "Mom, I wish you'd quit worrying about burying me," he said. "I'm going to die at sea." His mother was taken aback, but they talked a bit longer, and at one point he asked whether she still had his high school trophies. "Of course I do," she said. "Well, make sure you keep them for my son," he said, and kissed her goodbye. "It took my breath away," says his mother. And then he was gone. I mean, 1 minute he was there, the next he was out the door. I didn't even have time to think. He was a rough, tough man. He wasn't exactly a house person. Murph left for Boston in late June by train. He was scared of flying. He brought with him the joy of cooking, which his mother had given him, because he loved to cook on board the boats. He'd taken his sea blanket to Deborah's to wash, but forgot to retrieve it, and so Deborah folded it and put it up for his return. He'd told her he'd be home by November 2nd to take her out to dinner on her birthday. "You'd better be," she said. After the first trip, he called her and said he'd made over $6,000 and that he was going to send a package down for Dale Jr. He didn't call his parents because Deborah said she'd call for him. He talked to his son for a while and then said goodbye to Deborah and hung up the phone. That was September 23rd. The Andrea Gale was due to leave within hours. By 10 o'clock, average wind speed is 40 knots out of the north-northeast, spiking to twice that and generating a huge sea. The Andrea Gale is a square transom boat, meaning the stern is not tapered or rounded, and she tends to ride up the face of a following sea rather than slice through it. Every time a large sea rises to her stern, the Andrea Gale slews to one side, and Billy must fight the wheel to keep from broaching. Broaching is when the boat turns broadside to the seas and rolls over. Fully loaded steel boats don't recover from broachings. They downflood and sink. If Billy's still running with the weather, he's taking seas almost continually over his stern and running a real risk of having a hatch cover or watertight door tear loose. And to make matters worse, the waves have an exceptionally short period. Instead of coming every 15 seconds or so, the waves now come every 8 or 9. The shorter the period, the steeper the wave faces, and the closer they are to breaking. 45-foot breaking waves are much more destructive than rolling swells twice that size. According to buoy 44139, maximum wave heights for October 28th coincide with exceptionally low periods right around 10 o'clock. It's a combination that a boat the size of the Andrea Gale couldn't take for long. Certainly by 10, if not earlier, but no later than 10, Billy Tyne must have decided to bring his boat around into the seas. If there's a maneuver that raises the hairs on the back of a captain's neck, it's coming around in large seas. The boat is broadside to the waves, beam to, for half a minute or so, which is easily long enough to get rolled over. Even aircraft carriers are at risk when they're beam to in a big sea. If Billy attempts to come around that late in the storm, he'd make sure the decks were cleared and give her full power on the way around. The Andrea Gale would list way over, and Billy would peer out of the windows to see what was bearing down on them. With luck, he'd pick a lull between the waves, and they'd round up into the weather without any problem. Billy's been through a lot of storms, though, and he's probably brought her around earlier in the evening, maybe even before talking to Barry. Either way, it's a significant moment. It means they've stopped steaming home and are simply trying to survive. In a sense, Billy's no longer at the helm. The conditions are, and all he can do is react. If danger can be seen in terms of a narrowing range of choices, Billy Tyne's choices have just ratcheted down a notch. A week ago, he could have headed in early. A day ago, he could have run north like Johnston. An hour ago, he could have radioed to see if there were any other vessels around. Now the electrical noise has made the VHF practically useless, and the single sideband only works for long range. These aren't mistakes so much as an inability to see into the future. No one, not even the Weather Service, knows for sure what a storm's going to do. There are distinct drawbacks to heading into the weather, though. The windows are exposed to breaking seas, the boat uses more fuel, and the bow tends to catch the wind and drag the boat to leeward. The Andrea Gale has a high bow that would force Billy to oversteer simply to stay on course. One can imagine Billy standing at the helm and gripping the wheel with the force and stance one might use to carry a cinder block. It would be a confused sea, mountains of water converging, diverging, piling up on themselves from every direction. A boat's motion can be thought of as the instantaneous integration of every force acting upon it in a given moment. And the motion of a boat in a storm is so chaotic as to be almost without pattern. Billy would just keep his bow pointed into the worst of it and hope he doesn't get blindsided by a freak wave. The degree of danger Billy's in can be gauged from the beating endured by the conship Holland, 200 or so miles to the east. The Holland is a big ship, 542 feet and 10,000 tons, and capable of carrying almost 700 land-sea containers on her decks. She could easily take the Andrea Gale as cargo. From her daily log, October 29th, 30th. 0400. Ship labors hard in very high following seas. 1200. Ship labors in very high stormy seas, hurricane gusts, water over deck and deck cargo. Ship strains heavily. Travel reduced. 0200. Steering weather-dependent course. Ship no longer obeys rudder. Ship strains hard and lurches heavily. 0400. Containers are missing from Bay 6. In other words, Billy's riding out a storm that has forced a 10,000-ton container ship to abandon course and simply steer to survive. The next high seas report comes in at 11 p.m., and Tommy Barry mulls it over while waiting for Billy to call. The storm is supposed to hit just west of the tail, around the 42 and the 45, but the Weather Service doesn't always know everything. The 42 and the 55 are only about 100 miles southeast of Billy, so he's a much more reliable source for local conditions than the weather radio. It's possible, Barry thinks, that the Allison could get away with fishing a little gear that night. Two sections may be 8 miles of line. Barry's the westernmost boat of the main fleet, so whatever is on the way is going to hit him first. But first of all, it's going to hit Billy Tyne. Barry waits 20-30 minutes, but Billy never calls. That's not as bad as it sounds. We're all big boys out there, as Barry says, and can take care of ourselves. Maybe Billy's got his hands full, or maybe he went below to take a nap, or maybe he simply forgot. Finally, around midnight, Barry tries to raise Billy himself. He can't get through, though, which is more serious. It means the Andrea Gale has sunk, has lost her antennas, or there's such pandemonium on board that no one can get to the radio. Barry guesses it's the antennas. They're bolted to a steel mast behind the wheelhouse, and although they're high up, they're fragile. Most sword boats have lost them at one point or another, and there's not much that can be done about it until the weather calms down. You can't even survive a walk across the deck during Force 12 conditions, much less a trip up the mast. Losing the antennas would seriously affect the Andrea Gale. It would mean they'd lost their GPS, radio, weather fax, and LORAN. And a wave that had taken out their antennas may well have also stripped them of their radar, running lights, and floodlight. Not only would Billy not know where he was, he wouldn't be able to communicate with anyone or detect other boats in the area. He'd basically be back in the 19th century. There's not much he could do at this point but keep the Andrea Gale pointed into the seas and hope the windows don't get blown out. They're half-inch Lexan, but there's a limit to what they can take. The conch ship Holland took waves over her decks that peeled land-sea containers open like sardine cans, 40 feet above the surface. The Andrea Gale's pilot house is half that high. Around midnight, a curious thing happens. The Sable Island storm eases up a bit. The winds drop a few knots, and maximum wave heights fall about 10 feet. Their periods lengthen as well, meaning there are fewer breaking waves. Instead of crashing through walls of water, the Andrea Gale rises up the face of each wave and plunges down its backside. 45-foot waves have an angled face of 60 or 70 feet, which is nearly the length of the boat. On exceptionally big waves, the Andrea Gale has her stern in the trough and her bow still climbing toward the crest. The lull, such as it is, lasts until 1 a.m. At that point, the center of the low is directly over the Andrea Gale. It's possible that the low, with its ferocious winds and extremely tight pressure gradient, has developed an eye similar to that of a hurricane. 2 days later, satellite photographs will show clouds swirling into its center like water down a drain. Dry Arctic air wraps 1.5 times around the low before finally making it into the center, an indication of how fast the system's spinning. On October 28th, the center isn't that well defined, but it may serve to take the edge off the conditions just a bit. The reprieve doesn't last long, though. Within a couple of hours, the waves are back up to 70 feet. A 70-foot wave has an angled face of well over 100 feet. The sea state has reached levels that no one on the boat and few people on Earth have ever seen. When the conch ship Holland finally limped into port several days later, one of her officers stepped off and swore he'd never set foot on another ship again. She'd lost 36 land-sea containers over the side, and the ship's owners promptly hired an American meteorological consultant to help defend them against lawsuits. The storm resulted in large-scale destruction of offshore shipping and coastal installations from Nova Scotia to Florida, wrote Bob Raguso of Weather News New York. It was called an extreme nor'easter by U.S. scientists and ranked as one of the 5 most intense storms from 1899 to 1991. It had the highest significant wave heights either arrived at by measurement or calculation. Some scientists termed it the 100-year storm. The Andrea Gale is at the epicenter of this storm and almost on top of the Sable Island shoals. It's very likely she has lost her antennas, or Billy would have radioed Tommy Barry that things looked bad. And definitely don't fish any gear that night. On the other hand, it's debatable whether the sea state could have overwhelmed Billy's boat that early in the evening. The 55-foot Fairwind didn't flip until winds hit 100 knots and the waves were running 70 feet. A more likely scenario is that Billy manages to get through the 10 o'clock spike in weather conditions, but takes a real beating. The windows are out, the electronics are dead, and the crew is terrified. For the first time, they are completely, irrevocably on their own. Graveyard of the Atlantic. In a few days, the El Dorado expedition went into the patient wilderness that closed upon it like the sea closes over a diver. Long afterwards, the news came back that all the donkeys were dead. Joseph Conrad, Heart of Darkness. Albert Johnston. I was the first one to know how bad it was really going to be. Halifax called for 20-meter seas, and when we heard that, we thought, oh boy, you don't really have time to run to land, so we tried to get into the coldest water we could find. The colder the water, the denser it is, and the waves don't get as big. Also, I knew we'd get a northeast-northwest wind. I wanted to make as much headway as possible, 'cause the Gulf Stream was down south, and that's where the warm water and fast current are. There was an awful lot of electrical noise along the leading edge of this thing. There was so much noise, you couldn't hear anything on the radio. I was up in the wheelhouse. When it's bad like that, I usually stay up there. If it looks like it's settling down a bit, and I can grab a little sleep, then I will. The crew just racks out and watches videos. Everybody acknowledged this was the worst storm they'd ever been in. You can tell by the size of the waves, the motion of the boat, the noise, the crashing. There's always a point when you realize that you're in the middle of the ocean, and if anything goes wrong, that's it. You see so much bad weather that you kind of get used to it. But then you see really bad weather, and that you never get used to. They had ship reports of 30-meter seas. That's 90 feet. I would imagine, truthfully in retrospect, that if the whole U.S. swordfish fleet had been caught in the center of that thing, everybody would have gone down. We only saw, I don't know, maybe 50-foot waves max. We went into it until it started to get dark, and then we turned around and went with it. You can't see those rogue waves in the dark, and you don't want to get blasted and knock your wheelhouse off. We got the RPM tuned in just right to be in sync with the waves. Too fast, and we'd start surfing. Too slow, and the waves would just blast right over the whole boat. The boat was heavy and loaded with fish, very stable. It made for an amazingly good ride. Johnston had finished his last haul late in the afternoon of the 28th. 19 swordfish, 20 big eye, 22 yellowfin, and 2 mako. He immediately started steaming north, and by morning he was approaching the tail of the banks. Winds out of the northeast at 100 knots, and seas 20 to 30 feet. Several hundred miles to the west, though, conditions have gone off the chart. The Beaufort wind scale defines a Force 12 storm as having 73-mile-an-hour winds and 45-foot seas. Due south of Sable Island, data buoy 44137 starts notching 75-foot waves on the afternoon of the 29th and stays up there for the next 17 hours. Significant wave height, the average of the top third, also known as H-Sig, tops 50 feet. The first 100-foot wave spikes the graph at 8 p.m., and the second one spikes it at midnight. For the next 2 hours, peak wave heights stay at 100 feet, and winds hit 80 miles an hour. The waves are blocking the data buoy readings, though, and the wind is probably hitting 120 or so. 80-mile-an-hour wind can suck fish right out of bait barrels. 100-foot waves are 50% higher than the most extreme sizes predicted by computer models. They're the largest waves ever recorded on the Scotian Shelf. They're among the very highest waves measured anywhere in the world, ever. Scientists understand how waves work, but not exactly how huge ones work. There are rogue waves out there, in other words, that seem to exceed the forces generating them. For all practical purposes, though, heights of waves are a function of how hard the wind blows, how long it blows for, and how much sea room there is. Speed, duration, and fetch, as it's known. Force 12 winds over Lake Michigan would generate wave heights of 35 feet after 10 hours or so. But the waves couldn't get any bigger than that because the fetch, the amount of open water, isn't great enough. The waves have reached what is called a fully developed sea state. Every wind speed has a minimum fetch and duration to reach a fully developed sea state. Waves driven by a force 12 wind reach their full potential in 3 or 4 days. A gale blowing across 1,000 miles of ocean for 60 hours would generate significant wave heights of 97 feet. Peak wave heights would be more than twice that. Waves that size have never been recorded, but they must be out there. It's possible that they would destroy anything in a position to measure them. All waves, no matter how huge, start as rough spots, cat's paws, on the surface of the water. The cat's paws are filled with diamond-shaped ripples, called capillary waves, that are weaker than the surface tension of water and die out as soon as the wind stops. They give the wind some purchase on an otherwise glassy sea, and at winds over 6 knots, actual waves start to build. The harder the wind blows, the bigger the waves get, and the more wind they are able to catch. It's a feedback loop that has wave height rising exponentially with wind speed. Such waves are augmented by the wind, but not dependent on it. Were the wind to stop, the waves would continue to propagate by endlessly falling into the trough that precedes them. Such waves are called gravity waves or swells. In cross-section, they're symmetrical sine curves that undulate along the surface with almost no energy loss. A cork floating on the surface moves up and down, but not laterally when a swell passes beneath it. The higher the swells, the farther apart the crests and the faster they move. Antarctic storms have generated swells that are half a mile or more between crests and travel 30 or 40 miles an hour. They hit the Hawaiian Islands as breakers 40 feet high. Unfortunately for mariners, the total amount of wave energy in a storm doesn't rise linearly with wind speed, but to its fourth power. The seas generated by a 40-knot wind aren't twice as violent as those from a 20-knot wind. They're 17 times as violent. A ship's crew watching the anemometer climb even 10 knots could well be watching their death sentence. Moreover, high winds tend to shorten the distance between wave crests and steepen their faces. The waves are no longer symmetrical sine curves. They're sharp peaks that rise farther above sea level than the troughs fall below it. If the height of the wave is more than 1/7 the distance between the crests, the wavelength, the waves become too steep to support themselves and start to break. In shallow water, waves break because the underwater turbulence drags on the bottom and slows the waves down, shortening the wavelength and changing the ratio of height to length. In open ocean, the opposite happens. Wind builds the waves up so fast that the distance between crests can't keep up, and they collapse under their own mass. Now, instead of propagating with near-zero energy loss, the breaking wave is suddenly transporting a huge amount of water. It's cashing in its chips, as it were, and converting all its potential and kinetic energy into water displacement. A general rule of fluid dynamics holds that an object in the water tends to do whatever the water it replaces would have done. In the case of a boat in a breaking wave, the boat will effectively become part of the curl. It will either be flipped end over end or shoved backward and broken on. Instantaneous pressures of up to 6 tons per square foot have been measured in breaking waves. Breaking waves have lifted a 2,700-ton breakwater en masse and deposited it inside the harbor at Wick, Scotland. They've blasted open a steel door 195 feet above sea level at Unst Light in the Shetland Islands. They've heaved a half-ton boulder 91 feet into the air at Tillamook Rock, Oregon. There's some evidence that average wave heights are slowly rising, and that freak waves of 80 or 90 feet are becoming more common. Wave heights off the coast of England have risen an average of 25% over the past couple of decades, which converts to a 20-foot increase in the highest waves over the next half century. One cause may be the tightening of environmental laws, which has reduced the amount of oil flushed into the oceans by oil tankers. Oil spreads across water in a film several molecules thick and inhibits the generation of capillary waves, which in turn prevent the wind from getting a grip on the sea. Plankton releases a chemical that has the same effect, and plankton levels in the North Atlantic have dropped dramatically. Another explanation is that the recent warming trend, some call it the greenhouse effect, has made storms more frequent and severe. Waves have destroyed docks and buildings in Newfoundland, for example, that haven't been damaged for decades. As a result, stresses on ships have been rising. The standard practice is to build ships to withstand what is called a 25-year stress, the most violent condition the ship is likely to experience in 25 years. The wave that flooded the wheelhouse of the Queen Mary, 90 feet up, must have nearly exceeded her 25-year stress. North Sea oil platforms are built to accommodate a 111-foot wave beneath their decks, which is calculated to be a 100-year stress. Unfortunately, the 25-year stress is just a statistical concept that offers no guarantee about what will happen next year or next week. A ship could encounter several 25-year waves in a month or never encounter any at all. Naval architects simply decide what level of stress she's likely to encounter in her lifetime and then hope for the best. It's economically and structurally impractical to construct every boat to 100-year specifications. Inevitably, then, ships encounter waves that exceed their stress rating. In the dry terminology of naval architecture, these are called non-negotiable waves. Mariners call them rogue waves or freak seas. Typically, they're very steep and have an equally steep trough in front of them. A hole in the ocean, as some witnesses have described it. Ships cannot get their bows up fast enough, and the ensuing wave breaks their back. Maritime history is full of encounters with such waves. When Sir Ernest Shackleton was forced to cross the South Polar Sea in a 22-foot open lifeboat, he saw a wave so big that he mistook its foaming crest for a moonlit cloud. He only had time to yell, "Hang on, boys, it's got us," before the wave broke over his boat. Miraculously, they didn't sink. In February 1883, the 320-foot steamship Glamorgan was swept bow to stern by an enormous wave that ripped the wheelhouse right off the deck, taking all the ship's officers with it. She later sank. In 1966, the 44,000-ton Michelangelo, an Italian steamship carrying 775 passengers, encountered a single massive wave in an otherwise unremarkable sea. Her bow fell into a trough, and the wave stove in her bow, flooded her wheelhouse, and killed a crewman and two passengers. In 1976, the oil tanker Cretan Star radioed, "Vessel was struck by a huge wave that went over the deck and was never heard from again." The only sign of her fate was a 4-mile oil slick off Bombay. South Africa's wild coast, between Durban and East London, is home to a disproportionate number of these monsters. The 4-knot Agulhas Current runs along the continental shelf a few miles offshore and plays havoc with swells arriving from Antarctic gales. The current shortens their wavelengths, making the swells steeper and more dangerous, and bends them into the fast water the way swells are bent along a beach. Wave energy gets concentrated in the center of the current and overwhelms ships that are there to catch a free ride. In 1973, the 12,000-ton cargo ship Ben Cruachan was cracked by an enormous wave off Durban and had to be towed into port, barely afloat. Several weeks later, the 12,000-ton Neptune Sapphire broke in half on her maiden voyage after encountering a freak sea in the same area. The crew were hoisted off the stern section by helicopter. In 1974, the 132,000-ton Norwegian tanker Wilstar fell into a huge trough. "There was no sea in front of the ship, only a hole," said one crew member, and then took an equally huge wave over her bow. The impact crumbled inch-thick steel plate like sheet metal and twisted railroad gauge I-beams into knots. The entire bow bulb was torn off. The biggest rogue on record was during a Pacific gale in 1933, when the 478-foot Navy tanker Ramapo was on her way from Manila to San Diego. She encountered a massive low-pressure system that blew up to 68 knots for a week straight and resulted in a fully developed sea that the Ramapo had no choice but to take on her stern. Unlike today's tankers, the Ramapo's wheelhouse was slightly forward of amidships. Early on the morning of February 7th, the watch officer glanced astern and saw a freak wave rising up behind him that lined up perfectly with a crow's nest above and behind the bridge. Simple geometry later showed the wave to be 112 feet high. Rogue waves such as that are thought to be several ordinary waves that happen to get in step, forming highly unstable piles of water. Others are waves that overlay long-distance swells from earlier storms. Such accumulations of energy can travel in threes, a phenomenon called the Three Sisters, and are so huge that they can be tracked by radar. There are cases of the Three Sisters crossing the Atlantic Ocean and starting to shoal along the 100-fathom curve off the coast of France. 100 fathoms is 600 feet, which means that freak waves are breaking over the continental shelf as if it were a shoreline sandbar. Most people don't survive encounters with such waves, and so first-hand accounts are hard to come by, but they do exist. An Englishwoman named Beryl Smeaton was rounding Cape Horn with her husband in the 1960s when she saw a shoaling wave behind her that stretched away in a straight line as far as she could see. "The whole horizon was blotted out by a huge gray wall," she writes in her journal. "It had no curling crest, just a thin white line along the whole length, and its face was unlike the sloping face of a normal wave. This was a wall of water with a completely vertical face, down which ran white ripples like a waterfall." The wave flipped the 46-foot boat end over end, snapped Smeaton's harness, and threw her overboard. Tommy Berry had a similar experience off George's Bank. He was laying to in a storm when a wave clobbered him out of nowhere, imploding his windows. "There was this boom, and the Lexan window was blown right off," he says. "The window hit the clutch, and so the clutch was pinned, and we couldn't get her into gear. The boat's over a bit, laying in a beam sea and shit flying everywhere. Things that have never moved on that boat before going all over the place. The wave ripped the life raft off its mount and blew the front hatch open. It was dogged down, but there was so much water it blew it open anyway. I came up quick and radioed the Miss Millie. 'Larry, we took a hell of a wave. Stand by, I'm here.' I took the boat down sea, and about 10 minutes later, the same wave hit him. His bird came out of the water, and the hull took a big dent." If a wave takes Billy's windows out, it would be similar to the one experienced by Smeaton or Barry. Big, steep, and unexpected. It's an awful scene to imagine. Water knee-deep in the wheelhouse. Men scrambling up the companionway. Wind screaming through the blown-out window. If enough water gets in, it can make its way down to the engine room, soak the wiring, and take on an electric charge. The entire boat gets electrified. Anyone standing in water gets electrocuted. A boat that loses her windows can start filling up with water in minutes. So two men tie safety lines to their waists and crawl out onto the whaleback deck with sheets of marine plywood. The plywood acts like a kite. You have to manhandle the son of a bitch, says Charlie Reed. It's a horrible thought, someone out there in that weather. As captain, it's your worst fear, someone going over the side. It's hard to find a more dangerous job than venturing onto the whaleback during a storm to do a little carpentry. On land, a 100-knot wind reduces people to a crawl. At sea, it knocks you flat. The decks are awash, the boat is rolling, the spray is raking you like grape shot. You work in the calm of the wave troughs and flatten yourself at the crests to keep from being blown off the boat. One man holds the plywood against the window, while the other lines up a power drill with the holes in the wheelhouse and starts drilling. He drills one hole, hammers a bolt through, and then someone in the wheelhouse threads on the nut, while the men on the outside keep drilling and bolting until the plywood is screwed down tight. Some captains put a piece of inner tube between the wood and steel to make it waterproof. Although it's a suicidal job, crews that lose their windows almost always manage to get some plywood up, even if it means turning down sea to do it. After the plywood is bolted down, the crew starts bucket bailing the wheelhouse and putting the cabin back in order. Maybe someone tries to wire the Loran or radio up to a battery to see if he can get a signal. Billy starts shifting fuel from one tank to another, trying to trim the boat. Someone probably checks the engine room and work deck. Are the scuppers clearing their water? Are the birds down? Is the fish hatch secure? There's not much they can do at this point but head into the storm and hope they don't take any more big waves. If waves keep taking out their windows, they could turn around and go down sea, but that generates a whole new set of problems. Several large waves could simply bury them, or the lazarette could flood, or sediment could get stirred up in the tanks and clog the fuel filters. If the ship motion is violent enough, the crew has to change the filters non-stop, pull them out, flush the sediment, put them back in again, over and over as fast as they can, or the engine stops and the boat goes over. There's no question Billy would radio for help now if he had the capability. All he'd have to do is say, "Mayday," on channel 16 or 2182 kilohertz, and give his coordinates. 16 and 2182 are monitored by the Coast Guard, the military, and all ocean-going vessels. According to maritime law, any vessel that picks up a mayday must respond immediately unless their own lives would be put in danger. The Coast Guard would send out an Aurora rescue plane to locate the Andrea Gale and circle her. A rescue swimmer and helicopter crew would be placed on standby at the airbase outside Halifax. The Canadian Coast Guard cutter, Edward Cornwallis, would start steaming east out of Halifax on what would probably be a 36-hour trip. The Triumph Sea, an ocean-going tug based at a drilling platform off Sable Island, would put to sea as well. The Conship Holland, the Zara, and possibly the Mary T would all try to converge on Billy. Once there, they wouldn't be able to leave until the Coast Guard signs them off. Presumably, then, Billy's radios are out. The Coast Guard never receives a call. Now his only link to the rest of the world is his EPIRB, which sits outside in a plastic holster on the whaleback deck. It's about the size of a bowling pin and has a ring switch that can be set to off, on, or armed. EPIRBs are kept permanently in the armed position, and if the boat goes down, a water-sensitive switch triggers a radio signal that gets relayed by satellite to listening posts on shore. The Coast Guard immediately knows the name of the boat, the location, and that something has gone disastrously wrong. If a boat loses her radios before actually sinking, though, the captain can send a distress signal by just twisting the ring switch to the on position. It's the same as screaming Mayday into the radio. Billy doesn't do it, though. He never trips the switch. This can only mean one thing, that he's hopeful about their chances right up until the moment when they have no chance at all. He must figure that the kind of sea that took out their windows probably won't hit again, or that if it does, they'll be able to take it. Statistically, a 40-knot wind generates 30 or 40-foot breaking sea every 6 minutes or so. Green water over the bow and white water over the house. Every hour, perhaps, Billy might get hit by a breaking 50-footer. That's probably the kind of wave that blew out the windows. And every 100 hours, Billy can expect to run into a non-negotiable wave, a breaking 70-footer that could flip the boat end over end. He's got to figure the storm's going to blow out before his 100 hours are up. Everyone on a sinking boat reacts differently. A man on one Gloucester boat just curled up and started to cry, while his shipmates worked untethered on deck. The Andrea Gale crew, all experienced fishermen, are probably trying to shrug it off as just another storm. They've been through this before. They'll go through it again. And at least they're not puking. Billy's undoubtedly working too hard at the helm to give drowning much thought. Ernie Hazard claims it was the last thing on his mind. There was no conversation, just real businesslike, he says of going down off George's Bank. You know, let's just get this thing done. Never any overwhelming sense of danger. We were just very, very busy. Be that as it may, certain realities still must come crashing in. At some point, Tyne, Shatford, Sullivan, Moran, Murphy, and Pierre must realize there's no way off this boat. They could trigger the EPIRB, but a night rescue in these conditions would be virtually impossible. They could deploy the life raft, but they probably wouldn't survive the huge seas. If the boat goes down, they go down with it, and no one on Earth can do anything about it. Their lives are utterly and completely in their own hands. That fact must settle into Bobby Shatford's stomach like a bad meal. It was he, after all, who had those terrible misgivings the day they left. That last afternoon on the dock, he came within a hair's breadth of saying no, just telling Chris to start up the car and drive. They could have gone back to her place, or up the coast, or anywhere at all. It wouldn't have mattered. He wouldn't be in this storm right now, and neither would the rest of them. It would have taken Billy at least a day to replace him, and right now they'd still be east with the rest of the fleet. The previous spring, Bobby and Chris rented a movie called The Fighting Sullivans, about five brothers who died on a U.S. Navy boat during World War II. It was Ethel's favorite movie. Sitting there with Chris, watching the movie, and thinking about his brothers, Bobby started to cry. He was not a man who cried easily, and Chris was unsure what to do. Should she say something? Pretend not to notice? Turn off the TV? Finally, Bobby said that he was upset by the idea of all his brothers fishing, and that if anything happened to him, he wanted to be buried at sea. Chris said that nothing was going to happen to him, but he insisted. Just bury me at sea, he said. Promise me that. And now here he is, getting buried at sea. The conditions have degenerated from bad to unspeakable. Beaufort Force 10 or 11. The British Manual of Seamanship describes a Force 10 gale as foam is in great patches and is blown in dense white streaks along the direction of the wind. The rolling of the sea becomes heavy and shock-like. Force 11 is even worse. Exceptionally high waves, small or medium-sized ships might be lost from view behind them. The sea is completely covered with long patches of white foam. Hurricane Grace is still working her way north, and when she collides with the Sable Island storm, probably in a day or so, conditions will get even more severe, maybe as high as Force 12. Very few boats that size can withstand a Force 12 gale. Since Billy presumably can't use his radio, there's no way to know how things are going aboard the Andrea Gale. A fairly good idea, though, can be had from the Asian Maru 78, the Japanese longliner 200 miles to the southwest. The Asian Maru has a Canadian observer on board, Judith Reeves, who is charged with making sure the vessel abides by Canadian fishing regulations. The storm hits the Asian Maru around the same time as the Andrea Gale, but not as abruptly. Buoy 44137, 60 miles to the south, shows a slow, gradual increase in wind speed starting at 5 p.m. on the 28th. By dawn on the 29th, the wind is 40 knots, gusting to 50, and peak wave heights are only 45 feet. That's considerably less than what Billy is experiencing, but it just keeps getting worse. By midnight, sustained wind speeds are 50 knots, gusts are hitting 60, and peak wave heights are over 100 feet. At 10 past 8 at night, October 29th, the first big wave hits the Asian Maru. It blows out a port side window with the sound of a shotgun going off. Water inundates the bridge and barrels down the hallway into Reeves' room. She hears panicked shouts from the crew and then orders that she doesn't understand. Men scramble to board up the window and bail out the water, and within an hour the captain has regained control of the bridge. The boat is taking a horrific beating, though. She's 150 feet long, twice the size of the Andrea Gale, and waves are completely burying her decks. There are no life jackets on hand, no survival suits, and no EPIRB. Just before dawn, the second wave hits. It blows out four windows this time, including the one with plywood over it. All the circuits went. There was smoke and wires crackling, says Reeves. We crippled the ship, the VHF, the radar, the internal communication system, the navigation monitors. They were all rendered inoperable. That's when the radio operator came to me and said, in sign language, that he wanted me to go into the radio room. The radio operator had managed to contact the ship's agent by satellite phone, and Reeves is put on the line to explain what kind of damage they've sustained. While she's talking, Coast Guard New York breaks in. They've been listening in on the conversation and want to know if the Asian Maru needs help. Reeves says they've lost most of their electronics and are in serious trouble. New York patches her through to the Coast Guard in Halifax, and while they're discussing how to get people off the boat, the radio operator interrupts her. He's pointing to a sentence in an English phrase book. Reeves leans in close to read it. We are helpless and drifting. Please render all assistance. Unknown to Reeves, the steering linkage has just failed, although the radio operator doesn't know how to explain that to her. It's at this moment that Reeves realizes she's going down at sea. We had no steerage, and we were right in the eye of the storm, she says. It was a confused sea. All the waves were coming from different directions. The wind was picking up the tops of the waves and slinging them so far that when the search and rescue plane arrived, we couldn't even see it. The whole vessel would get shoved over on its side so that we were completely upside down. If you get hit by one wave and then hit by another, you can drive the vessel completely down into the water. And so that second before the vessel starts to come up, you're just holding your breath, waiting. They're dead in the water, taking the huge waves broadside. According to Reeves, they're doing 360-degree barrel rolls and coming back up. Four boats try to respond to her mayday, but three of them have to stand down because of the weather. They cannot continue without risking their own lives. The ocean-going tug Triumph C leaves Sable Island and claws her way southward, and the Coast Guard cutter Edward Cornwallis is on her way from Halifax. The crew of the Ocean Maru, impassive, are sure they're going to die. Reeves is too busy to think about it. She has to look for the life jackets, work the radio and satellite phone, flip through the Japanese phrase book. Eventually, she has a moment to consider her options. Either I jump ship, or I go down with the ship. As for the first possibility, I thought about it for a while until I realized that they'd hammered all the hatches down. I thought, God, I'll never get off this friggin' boat. It will be my tomb. So I figured I'd do whatever I had to do at the time, and there was no point in really thinking about it, because it was just too frightening. I was just gripped by this feeling that I was going to have to do something very unpleasant. You know, like drowning is not going to be pleasant. And it wasn't until the moment we lost steerage that I actually thought we were going to die. I mean, I knew there was a real possibility, and I was going to have to face that. Soon after losing steerage, a communications officer in New York asks Reeves how it's going. Not too well, she says. Is your survival suit out? Yeah, it's here, she says. Well, how many Japanese can you fit into it? Reeves laughs. Even that slight joke is enough to ease the desperateness of the situation. A couple of hours later, the satellite phone rings. Improbably, it's a Canadian radio reporter who wants to interview her. His name is Rick Howe. Miss Reeves, is it rough out there? Howe asks over the static and wind shriek. It's pretty rough. What about the trawler? What's the problem? It's not a trawler. It's a longliner. The problem is we took three windows out of the bridge earlier this morning and lost all our instrumentation. Are you in any danger, or are you confident everything's going to work out all right? Well, we're in danger. Definitely, we're in danger. We're drifting in 12-meter swells and between 50 and 60 knot winds. If we get any more water coming through the bridge, that's going to wipe out any communication that we have left. So we're definitely in danger right now. Do you know how close the nearest ship to you is? We're looking at about 100 miles. If we have to abandon ship, there are helicopters that can be here in 3.5 hours. Unfortunately,